Conversations with Maria Menounos. Podcast edition. Inspiration.
Is there anything she can't handle? She looks fear in the face day after day, but yet she never runs. She's unbreakable. She's a warrior. She's you.
Growth.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Community.
These things happen because you have to live your true self in a bigger way.
Featuring the best of Maria Menounos' SiriusXM show with celebrity and life-changing interviews, thoughts on the week, and more. And it's free. All we ask is that you rate, comment, and subscribe on iTunes and tell a friend to subscribe to SiriusXM. Listen to Conversations with Maria Menounos on SiriusXM Stars 109 at 1 p.m. East. And now here's your host, Maria Menounos.
Happy Friday, everybody. Got an oldie but a goodie coming for you right now. I jam to this in my car, I blast it with the top down, and I ride around LA. Make it louder, Josh. Let's feel this.
Oh, I know this song.
It's by Extreme. It's called Wholehearted. I love this song.
Where does it bring you back immediately?
Back to Boston, baby.
Okay, cool. I didn't know that these guys are from Winchester.
They're from Winchester, Massachusetts.
Winchester, yeah.
They were kind of the only famous people I kind of knew, even though I didn't know them, because my cousin was friends with them, so I thought he was so cool.
Oh.
And so...
a cool cousin.
This is the best. Listen to this right here.
Even the sea is not so full of me. If I'm not blind, what can I see?
It's such a good song. Guys, if you want to feel some energy, play this in your car.
That can only be filled by you.
This makes me crazy, guys. I swear to God, I rediscovered it maybe like a year ago. And I would literally like pop it on in the car as I was leaving the gas station. And I'd peel out a little, of course. And it just makes you feel like so good. And it's spring right now. So like roll down your windows. I know most people don't have convertibles because that's kind of a California thing. But, you know, roll down your windows, pop your sunroof open and feel the vibe. It's so fun.
Yes.
So I wanted you guys to have a little fun with that. So our quote of the day, guys, don't limit yourself. Many people limit themselves to what they think they can do. You can go as far as your mind lets you. What you believe, remember, you can achieve. That was Mary Kay Ash. Does that have any connection to Mary Kay, the cosmetics lady?
Ooh, good question.
I don't think so. But it may be because look,
yes,
she did.
It's her.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. See? All right. So don't limit yourself. My dad always used to say, Maria, you can do whatever you put your mind to. And I remember we were cleaning nightclubs and I would be like, well, there's only one way up from here.
You thought that at that young of an age?
Oh, yeah.
That's hilarious.
I used to go up on the stage at the Channel. So it was like the biggest rock club in Boston.
Really?
And I grew up there. And from the time I was a baby, my parents would bring us to work because they couldn't afford babysitters. Yeah. And I just remember just dreaming of being on that stage for whatever reason. I didn't know what it was going to be. But, you know, bands would get really high and leave behind all their equipment. And so, like, I'd be up there playing drums or, like, messing around with guitars and stuff like that and fake performing for my parents. And yeah.
Wait, so you literally had the whole place to yourself, you and your brother and your parents?
Oh, yeah, because we had a clean. Like, we used to wade in trash. Like sometimes, like when they had big bands like the B-52s come through or Roy Orbison or whoever, like we would tell, like we would, you know, go in the club. I'll never forget. My dad would set the alarm off and we would run to the opening of the club. And then we would look to see how much trash was on the floor because that's how we would determine whether it was really busy.
Oh.
And that would kind of set our day. We're like, oh, shit, this is going to be a long one.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes there wasn't a lot on the ground and we're like, oh, yes, we're going to be out of here early. But most of the time it was like crazy vomit. And
did they know, the owners of the club, did they know that you and your brother were young and were in there cleaning?
Yeah, well,
because you guys,
I don't think they
necessarily knew
we were cleaning. I mean, you know, they knew we were there. My dad had like a little back office, which was really just like a storage room with a one of those heater things, like the furnaces, and we would sit back there and and sometimes we would sleep in boxes back there. I would like get boxes with cups and create a fort and sleep in there.
That must have been kind of cool though as a kid. That's like fun doing things like that.
Yeah, you just make it fun.
That's but how then you know music, I'm guessing. Sorry.
But that's, yeah, maybe.
You know so many bands and so much music. It has to be
like as of a certain point, like after the 90s. I don't know anything.
Yeah, but you do know all the 90s stuff. That makes total sense now that you're working at a
you
rock
just
club.
Solved that mystery for me too, Ashley.
Hey, that's what I'm here for, honey.
Co-host Ashley Daniels here to solve mysteries.
Detective Ashley Daniels solved another case.
You'll have to give Dr. or Detective Rod Demery a run for his money. He's on the show today.
I will have to.
But yeah, I my whole childhood was spent in a nightclub, and our friend was Al. He slept under a bridge near the channel, and he used to come, and my dad would give him beer because that's what he wanted, and in exchange he would take out the trash, and he was incredible, and he was like family. And then all the people that worked there were like family, and I would like sometimes we would be there so late that it would actually be close to like open time. So we'd get there at 5 a.m. and by like 5 p.m. we would still be there sometimes. So I would go into the office with like Brian and Donna and all, you know, and Debbie and all the people that worked in the offices. And I thought they were like the coolest people in the world.
How old were you?
I mean, I was like 13 by the time we left. So at this point, let's say 10, 11, 12, and I would go in there and they would let me answer the phone sometimes. And I'm like, show starts at 6. And, you know, doors open at 6, show time 9 or 7, whatever the time was. And it was so fun. And then I would go home with my friends and pretend to play office. And then I'd be Debbie because Debbie was the coolest.
Oh, so you got to be the cool one.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So wait, did you go to school when this would go on or was it weekends?
So this was weekends and then summers. So, and then days off, like holidays. We spent every holiday there. Christmas, New Year's, Easter.
Wow.
Every 365 days a year. So when I wasn't in school, I was there. And then the company, the nightclub filed for Chapter 11 when I was 13 and we lost the job there. But we used to clean multiple clubs. So we would go from that club to another club to another club. Hence the work ethic, Josh.
I
see it. Now you see where the crazy work ethic comes
absolutely.
From.
But wow, you grew up around a lot of cool. I mean, just thinking about Boston,
a lot of vomit, a lot of rats too.
But like, you know,
a lot of drugs.
What kid gets to experience
needles.
That and see that at such a young age? It's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like that Studio 54 vibe that you were kind of seeing the remnants of or the aftermath of all the time. Like as such a kid, I just can't imagine.
And it was the most historic club in Boston.
Wow,
it was cool. And then they built like this. Nightclub off the side of it. My dad literally with his like hands built it. And I remember I was helping him lay the final tiles down as people were walking in.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Have you ever gone back? I'm sure it's not there anymore, but have you gone back to the area or building?
I go back every time I'm there. I always go back
to that area.
Yeah. The first time I went back after moving to California, I bawled because it was gone. They had knocked it down. And I was like, it was almost like your house was knocked down.
Wow.
I bawled. I still get emotional. And when I was home most recently, my brother came up to me and he gave me a pick that said the channel from a guitar pick and he had held it all these years.
Oh my God.
And I was like, it was like this moment where I was like, oh my God, he really loves me. Like,
I just got goosebumps everywhere.
Really? It was a special moment because I'm taking guitar and I've always been like, ever since I started, I'm like, damn, those guitar picks were like a billion. They were everywhere. Why didn't I keep one?
How smart of him, huh? That he thought about that he kept it all those years.
Yeah. And then he also gave me my Spuds McKenzie back. So I had a Spuds McKenzie.
What's the Spuds McKenzie?
Oh my God. Spuds McKenzie was the mascot for Bud Light back in the day.
Oh.
It was one of those pit bulls, not like the long nose pit bull dogs.
Oh.
And so Josh will pull it up on Google so you can see.
Okay.
And so I had a Spuds McKenzie plug-in lamp.
Wait, what?
And that's Spuds. You see?
Oh.
He had the patch on his eye.
Oh, how cute.
Yeah, he was the coolest. He drank Bud Light. And so.
Yeah, I remember
Spuds. That is so cool.
Yeah. So my brother, back in his like bad days, he would steal shit from you. And once it was in his room, it was his. It was his property. The second it entered his sphere, it was his property. And so when we reconciled, he's like, I have your Spuds McKenzie.
No, he didn't.
And I go, shut up. He goes, I'm going to give it to you. And I was so excited. So when I came home this last trip, it was in my room, plugged in.
That's
and
sweet.
I'm like, oh my God. no damage, not broken after all these years. And it's you know, it's a sensitive material. It's not like plastic. It's almost like a plasticky glass kind of thing that could have broken.
I have to look this up.
It was really cool.
Spuds McKenzie.
Yeah, I don't know why
lamp.
I didn't take any pictures of it when I was home. I was too busy playing with the llamas, I think.
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, wow. Is it like that? Like one of these? Where
yeah, little... that's it. That's exactly it. He's got the blue. That's the lamp.
That's so cute.
He's wearing the blue sweater thing.
With the tongue out of his mouth. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That is really cute, actually. Oh.
So,
wow.
Those were the days.
So I have to say, I'm looking at your Twitter right now, and you're getting a lot of feedback from, you did an interview with Adam Carolla.
Oh, yeah. That was just yesterday, actually.
That's
first
so cool.
Podcast.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just like looking, and I cannot believe some of the things. Like, so many guys are reaching out to you saying how much they loved the interview.
I love that.
Yeah, man. That's just like.
That's nice.
It's, we got to change it. It's no longer every girl with the newsletter. It's got to be
women.
every boy
We're
and girl.
We have to give some guy tips.
We
Damn.
Have to. Damn. Yeah, like one guy said, great interview. It felt like a bit of an epiphany for me. Someone else said, you rocked on Adam Carolla. Keep smiling and live your life. And then someone else said something funny. He said, all joking aside, hearing Maria Menounos open up about her brain tumor as well as her struggles in Hollywood was very profound. It was comforting to hear that someone with Disney princess looks and charm can struggle with the same self-doubt as an ugly guy from Nebraska.
Oh, my God. What's his name?
His name is Carolla in Color.
Carolla in Color. Yeah. That's so sweet. Yeah, we had a pretty deep interview, you know, because Adam's co-host Brian also has a brain tumor. His is inoperable. Wow. So when I had a brain tumor party at my house for my mom, I had a brain tumor party, Josh, so that mom wouldn't feel so alone. And so I brought everyone I knew that had a brain tumor over, and we all like commiserated and told each other stories and connected and shared information. And it was actually really fun.
It sounds like a good time. It sounds very therapeutic too.
Yeah, it was probably, actually.
Yeah,
and so Brian was there, but he has a brain tumor that's inoperable because it's on his brain stem. But he's been doing really, really well. And so we had a lot to kind of share. It was like Adam in the middle and then me and Brian on each side. Brain tumors on either side. But I was talking to him about, because he was really just amazed that I am okay kind of betting on myself and just chilling and just kind of being for a little bit. And I said, I don't think I would have been able to do that before. In fact, I know I wouldn't have. And I think that's why it happened. Because there is a different path for me. I think God has a whole other plan for me than I had expected for myself. And yeah, now I really don't care. Like, I only want to do what's going to make me happy and fulfill me and help others. But I have no interest in anything else anymore just because it's going to make me a lot of money and, you know, by me and other people cool things. I'm not interested in it. And he was just looking at me like so confused.
Yeah. Well, it is a confusing thing because it for so many reasons, but just the fact that you got to that place in your life where money is not, it's no longer the thing that's just life or death. It's just for you, you would so rather choose something that feels good internally.
Yeah.
And that's crazy because when people that are climbing the ladder, money is so important to us. We would probably do like anything. We would take any job no matter what just because it's
going to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just get to that level of clarity.
But see, the key is
so inspiring.
Yeah. The key is like, I think you have to know that you're going to have to do some stuff you don't maybe 100% want to do in your journey. Right. And then if you do things smart along the way, then you can choose your destiny, right? So
that's great.
I've worked hard. My godfather always used to say, you know, that green stuff, it doesn't come with instructions. And I was like, thank you, Nana. And then Whoopi Goldberg was like, save 10% of your money. Just listen to me. And I did more than that. And so, you know, every time I'd get big chunks of money, I would pay off my mortgage and whatever it was. Like I just... You know, we invested, we did all these things the right way. And ultimately, I really do mean this. If I had to sell everything right now, I actually really don't care and I won't be embarrassed. And that's the thing I think with people is we're all embarrassed of what everybody's going to say. Right. I was talking to my cousin the other day. She was listening to the podcast last week with Anita Morjani. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I had 5 pages of notes and I'm making so many changes in my life because of it.
Wow.
And it's shaking some people up around me because I'm not the same. Or I'm not acting the same as I was before. I'm really taking myself into more consideration. And I said, that's amazing. And, you know, it's hard because, you know, even she was telling me, she's like, I'm having to make decisions right now that I wouldn't have made before because I would be afraid of what everybody was going to say. And now I don't care anymore. And listen, you don't want to be mean or rude or hurt people in the pursuit of your own happiness.
Right.
But I do think that ultimately, you know, when you've gotten to a certain place in life that you do have to choose you and your happiness to a big degree. And sometimes it's going to upset the apple cart, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's great. Great line.
But you have to do the work leading up to there.
Yeah,
like you can't
you can't start choosing early and thank you.
Yeah, like you're going to have to like take your lumps. Like that without the lumps, you won't get to these realizations, right? So mm-hmm. I don't look back and regret anything. All of those lumps led me to the place where I'm like, no mas. F this. No more. I don't care what you're putting in front of me. I am not going to like work with people like that again, or I'm not going to work in those scenarios again. I'm not going to do that anymore. Because, you know, at some point in your career, you can get trapped in that dream and you can get trapped in those situations where, you know, a poor girl who was cleaning nightclubs with her parents is like, okay, well, I would be complete asshole if I didn't say yes to all of this money and this prestige and stuff. You'd be an asshole. You'd be so stupid. But now it's like, you know what? My sanity means so much more to me. And if I have to sell everything and live in like an apartment down, you know, down the street or whatever it is I'd have to do to pursue my personal happiness, I will do now.
So if you could go back in time and mm-hmm. you can literally look at yourself, your 19-year-old self, 20-year-old self, that who just started off at Channel One, what's the one thing you would tell her?
I would tell her not to sweat a lot of the tough times as much and not to have sweat when things were going wrong because they were actually going right.
Okay.
I like that. I think I needed to hear that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think sometimes we get caught up so much in like a path that we set out for ourselves and mm-hmm. we have our own vision. And if it doesn't go that way, then we think that the path is the wrong path.
Yep.
And I think that's something that I'm learning right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough, but that's what I would say. So
wow.
There you have it.
Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Welcome back to Conversations with Maria Menounos, the podcast edition, where we bring you free, fresh source of news and inspiration and fun, plus the best of our SiriusXM shows from the week. You can find us here every Friday on Apple Podcasts. And like I said, we do this for free. So we please ask if you'll subscribe, rate, and review our show. I love reading the reviews. They really make me smile and makes me know that we're on the right track. Hope being that you'll like this podcast enough that maybe you'll want to join us on SiriusXM every day at 10 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time on channel 109. You can also find us on demand on the SiriusXM app. Today, we've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about stem cells and homicide. So it's actually two very different yet very, very interesting interviews. And so stay tuned. When we come back, we are going to be chatting with neurosurgeon and biomedicine scientist Bob Hariri, who's going to discuss the findings of his company Cellularity and the latest breakthroughs in stem cell research. It is fascinating. Joining me today, guys, is an entrepreneur in both biomedicine and aerospace. He is here to talk about his new company, Cellularity, whose mission is to find scientific breakthroughs in stem cell research in order to fight cancer and other diseases. Please welcome the very accomplished Dr. Bob Hariri. So, Dr. Bob, tell me, who are you?
We don't have enough time. I'm a complicated human being.
You are complicated. I mean, you're a neurosurgeon. You're doing all of these things. It's unbelievable.
I have a special category of attention deficit disorder that is kind of led me down a number of different pathways. But my sort of specialty is the science of biotechnology, and that's where I've made my home for the last 20, 25 years. I'm an MD PhD, which means I decided that I did one doctoral degree wasn't enough. I studied at Cornell and the Rockefeller Sloan Kettering System in New York, after being an engineer at Columbia in New York. And my, to be honest with you, I got into medicine sort of sideways. My passion early on was to be an airline pilot. I grew up in Queens, New York, geographically located between LaGuardia and Kennedy Airport, and watched these airplanes fly overhead, decided I was going to be a Pan Am 747 captain. That was my dream. So I entered the world sort of as an aviator, and then found my way to medicine, where I fell in love.
And so you are an actual pilot.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Do you fly yourself everywhere?
Yes.
Do you really?
Yeah, pretty much.
So when we were talking on the phone, you're like, I'm gonna fly into Santa Monica. You didn't mean like a private airline pilot's flying you in. You meant you.
Right. So I've been flying longer than I've done anything else in my life. I started flying at 13. So
Wait. At 13, how does that happen?
So, again, falling in love with airplanes and the concept of being able to go wherever you wanted to go got me interested in learning how to fly. So at 13, I started taking flying lessons out in a little tiny airport in Long Island called Edwards Airport. Started in Cessna 150s and moved my way up. Today I fly anything with wings on it.
But wait, how are you able to at 13 even take these lessons?
Oh, you can start flying. You can take lessons as early as you can reach the rudder pedals.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that.
My daughter, who's a big inspiration for the whole stem cell space and actually works with me now at Celularity, was the youngest licensed female pilot in the history of the United States.
Shut up.
Yeah.
I want her on the show. That's cool.
Yeah, she should come. She's a big fan of yours, and she knows a lot about these things. She sit on my lap in the cockpit. So, you know, I fly Challengers today. My wing Abago is a Challenger 604, which I've flown my family around the world multiple times.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a...
So, pilot, accomplished pilot, engineer, neurosurgeon, and now founder of this company that could be curing so many people, or is curing a lot of people as well.
So, you know, as a medical student, I always knew that I'd find my way into a career in surgery. And I was really intrigued by the biology of diseases that were a consequence of traumatic injury. So, I found my way into neurosurgery, specifically focused around head and spinal cord injury. And I worked with some brilliant people at Cornell. My old partner and other neurosurgeons there were just all great academic neurosurgeons, scientists, and practicing docs. And we got very interested in the biology that caused these serious injuries to become irreversible. And that's actually why stem cells appealed to me when they first hit the airwaves. We got very good at treating traumatic brain injury, but we couldn't reverse the damage that was done as a consequence of that event. So an attempt to turn back on the regenerative processes that could repair the brain, the only pathway I saw to doing that was this revolution in cellular medicine. And at the time, you probably remember, the place people were finding stem cells were embryos or the leftovers of an abortion.
Yeah.
Both of which were highly challenged by various factions, political factions, social and religious organizations were opposed to anything which potentially compromised a human being. And to be quite honest, you know, as a Catholic, I could, that resonated with me as well. But I saw that there were better solutions than using discarded embryos or creating an incentive to dispose of embryos. And so it dawned on me. I mentioned before, my daughter, when she was in utero, in the first trimester, I was a young surgeon at Cornell in the surgical ICU, and I ran down to look at the ultrasound during the early first trimester ultrasound, and it was the first time that it dawned on me that the placenta was a much bigger organ, despite the fact that she was an peanut-sized embryo. And in medical school, I was taught the placenta was the vascular interface between the mother and the developing fetus. If that was true, my engineering brain said they would develop at the same pace. Okay.
So would it be larger than the embryo at that time? That makes sense.
If all it was an interface, they would grow at the same pace. The fact that the placenta was already this big organ and the embryo was a little peanut got me thinking that maybe it was the governor, it was the rate limiter on embryonic development. Okay, so I got very interested in that.
So the placenta is already as big as the child will be fully developed.
So it's outpacing the growth of the developing embryo and fetus. So that suggested that it somehow controlled the development of that embryo well beyond just being a vascular connection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And I got fascinated by the organ, and I wondered why people weren't spending more time researching it. And
lot of women keep their placentas, and I'm pretty sure I heard they eat them, right?
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about that in a few minutes because that's an interesting angle. But the bottom line was, picture me in the early to mid-90s taking care of head trauma patients with my partners and interested in this emerging field of stem cells, and then seeing that in this country we were throwing away 4 million of these placentas, literally incinerating them, but maybe it held the answer to all the problems around sourcing stem cells. So that excited me so much that I decided to leave my position at Cornell and start a company. And the company was designed to use the platform of collecting materials at birth to isolate and harvest cells that could be stored away for the family.
But wasn't that illegal for so long?
No. It was highly, highly ethical, completely legal, and in fact, the industry had actually already begun to develop.
But stem cells were illegal.
Never illegal. Okay. So this is often a confusion. President Bush is sometimes criticized, or people think that he opposed stem cells. There's nothing further from the truth. In fact, I can tell you without a doubt, he is the only president that has ever involved himself in the questions and debate with the objective of advancing the field. I mean,
wow.
George Bush was highly, highly
senior
interested.
Or junior?
Junior. I mean,
okay. W
was
yeah.
very interested in finding a way to support stem cell science that had a practical basis upon which these tools could be deployed in a meaningful way.
Wow.
And you know what? The truth is that we learned very early embryonic stem cells and stem cells from an abortus had qualitative problems. I mean, significant qualitative problems. So just to give you an example, the time at which an embryo can be used to harvest a stem cell is so early in development, you don't know if that embryo is qualitatively good enough to go to a full-term pregnancy.
Mm.
One out of four, and only one out of four to one out of five conceived embryos ever gets beyond the first or second trimester. They spontaneously dissolute,
mm-hmm.
spontaneous abortions, et cetera, et cetera. The reason for that is underlying the biology of those embryos are some gross abnormalities not good enough to get through nature's quality control process.
Just like even when they're an egg and sperm trying to become an embryo as it's forming, I know because I did IVF, so many of them never made it. And, you know, you would do the embryo testing to see if they're even good enough to implant.
That's right. Exactly.
So it's the same process in the next phase, you're saying.
So think about in the Petri dish, quality control's hard. In the uterus, it's equally hard.
Yeah.
And you know, you've heard of late missed periods, mm-hmm. and you've heard of miscarriages. These are all nature's quality control process disposing of something not good enough to go to a full-term healthy pregnancy. So the beauty of saying, okay, we have this amazing resource, the end of a healthy birth, the placenta is going to be expelled and discarded. What if we use that as the source of these cells? So the company that I founded, LifeBank Anthrogenesis, actually made it its mission to collect placentas alongside collecting umbilical cord blood from which we could isolate cells that could be stored for families. And then we began to explore the placenta as a source of other stem cells that could solve the ethical moral debate about embryonic cells. And it turned out that the placenta is the richest source of stem cells known to mankind. The cells can be procured under rigorous controls. They can be recovered with a deep relationship with the donor family so that you can collect all the information necessary to meet regulatory requirements. And here's the best part. It's a living donor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Unlike an embryo, you destroy an embryo, there's no living donor left behind. The placenta, in contrast, is now a waste material, so there's no risk to the donor whatsoever. And these cells can be stored away for potentially a lifetime, but now you have the ability to have a relationship, an information relationship with the donor themselves, following health history and so on and so forth. This is very important at the at sort of the early phases when genomics was just hitting the airwaves, because before we could actually read a genome, we had to rely on medical history. So in my mind, the placenta was an abundant source, highly ethical to recover, highly scalable, highly economical, and you had the ability to inform a data set about how good those cells were to begin with, because you're looking at the health history of the individual.
Wow. So there's so much in there. Holy moly. I think, you know, so it's nice to know that the embryos, the stem cells wasn't illegal, because I also had that confusion. So you create Life Bank, and families are able to store. So, and I don't know the process of the placenta. So after you give birth, they remove the placenta?
Placenta is expelled normally.
It just comes out.
It's a natural process. The obstetrician, in some cases, will assist it. In nature, when the baby is first born, it's still connected to the placenta via the umbilical cord. What happens is, as the baby breathes, okay, and the lungs inflate, the circulation through the lungs and through the rest of the body changes, and it literally shuts off the blood supply to the placenta. So the placenta kind of perfuses the last few ounces of blood back into the fetus, and then the blood vessels start to constrict and contract. And then the placenta comes off the wall of the uterus and gets expelled. And then in normal biology, the cord is broken, and now the baby goes one way, the placenta goes somewhere else.
Got it.
Now, in nature, the placenta is generally recycled, meaning that other mammals eat the placenta.
Yeah. Right?
And in fact, the placenta is a major nutritional source for that immediate postpartum animal. And by the way, literature that I found years ago actually suggested that if you deprive an animal from eating the placenta after giving birth, their health is highly compromised. So
wow.
You mentioned some women eat the placenta.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that there's a biological basis for that.
Wow. So instead, you guys started with your company to take them, and you can store that for the future of that child only, or the family in general?
It's a great question. So here's what we know. Early on, this field developed because the stem cells left over in the blood of the placenta and umbilical cord contained all of the cells necessary to rebuild the blood and immune system. Okay, that cord blood was a well-established, well-recognized resource that could be put away, cryopreserved indefinitely, and had your child or the child's sibling, or in some cases other first or second degree relatives, developed a disease that needed their bone marrow to be rebuilt, those cells were readily available.
Wow.
So there was an immediate basis for doing this. And millions of families in the world have done this. And the statistics show that there is a predictable rate of usage for the family members, for the child themselves over time.
Mm-hmm.
But where the resource becomes far more valuable is later on in life. Early on, the frequency of needing the cells to treat a hematologic malignancy or a metabolic disorder or whatnot are relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
But since these cells can be stored for the lifetime of the donor, the probability that these cells are more valuable later in life is very high. And we did the research to show that these cells could literally be used later in life to extend the healthy lifespan of an individual.
This is what's so interesting. So Kevin and I have a baby. You take the placenta, you store it.
So we take the placenta, we isolate the cells, and we store the cells in cryopreservation systems.
Got it.
And by the way,
and you have to pay a fee for this, obviously, right?
If you do this privately, there's an upfront fee, and then there's an annual storage cost. It's sort of like the...
What does it run for someone who's listening right now?
So the upfront fee is a couple of $1,000, basically. Mm-hmm. Depends on the program you use.
Okay.
LifeBank USA is one of the premier providers. Our costs are around $2,000 upfront, depending upon what you do, mm-hmm. how many things you store away. And then the annual storage fees are a couple of hundred dollars a year.
Okay.
So it's less than a cell phone.
So you end up storing these cells for the future. So should something happen. But then also, if you want, you can use it for longevity of life.
So here's
the
thing.
So let's talk about that as well.
Okay. So when this all started, having these cells stored away was an insurance policy
yeah.
against a catastrophic thing. What do you worry about as a parent? God forbid my child develops cancer,
right? Or any of the horrible diseases.
You've seen on TV every day a family is searching for a match mm-hmm. for cells, right?
Yep.
Oh, please line up and be tested to see if you're a donor. Well, this obviated the need for that because these cells would be readily available, stored away, available in an instant. And so for the cost was highly justified because you could call upon this at a moment's notice
yeah.
to serve as
it's like going to the health ATM.
I love that. That's great. Can we trademark
you
that?
You can, yes.
So, and we argued that just like any other resource you put in storage, these things increase in value with your lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, we knew that there were a number of things these cells could be used to treat right away. But we told the consumers, we told the public that the industry was going to invest in research to make these cells useful for a vast array of more mainstream conditions, diabetes, musculoskeletal injuries, concussion, all that. The one company that invested in that research was my company. We were very fortunate. We were part of the premier biotech company in the world, Celgene. Celgene had deep interest in the fundamental science of cellular medicine and stem cells, and they'd allowed us to do the work, among which was work that showed us these cells could be used to treat all kinds of cancers. They could be used to treat degenerative diseases. They could be used to treat autoimmune disease, and they could be used in the research that we did to actually support the regenerative engine in your body that keeps you young.
So what kind of diseases and ailments are you guys helping with this therapy right now?
So our company, in its first form, Anthrogenesis Life Bank, in its subsequent form, the Cellular Therapy Division of Celgene Corporation, and today, independently as Cellularity, we have treated everything from autoimmune disease like Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, degenerative vascular disease, diabetic foot ulcer, et cetera, and most recently, cancer. So using cells from the placenta to augment your immune system. We call it augmented immunity, so that you're better capable of fighting cancer.
Wow. So what kind of results is that giving cancer patients?
So we are extremely excited about our early clinical results in some very serious malignancies where we're seeing response rates that are unprecedented, and we're seeing effective cures a year following treatment. Now, this is early. We have yet to really report this formally.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, somebody who's been in this field for 30 years, these results are revolutionary. But they're not unexpected. Okay, the field already knows that immunotherapy for cancer mm-hmm. is the next evolution of the treatment of that disease. This is not a surprise to anyone. It's how you deploy the tool that is so critical. Look, we know that organ transplant works, right?
Yeah.
Heart transplants, liver transplants, they work.
Yep.
Why isn't it used more frequently? No one's figured a way to productize a living organ. Okay.
What does that mean?
It means you can't, if you need a new liver, the process of getting a new liver is...
You have to get it from someone who's dying.
It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Finding a donor and finding a match is almost impossible.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is organ transplant could be used 1,000 times more frequently if there was a product available. With stem cells, we have the product that's available.
Oh, okay. I was like, how do we productize organs? This is so interesting.
So, by the way, with our fantastic strategic partner at Cellularity, a company called United Therapeutics, led by one of the most brilliant visionaries I know, Martine Rothblatt, who you should interview because she's remarkable. Martine's company, United Therapeutics, and Cellularity are working to ultimately bring off-the-shelf organ replacements
wow.
for this industry, all coming from the cells we talk about.
Wow. Dr. Hariri, I want to ask you the ultimate question for the women listening right now is, do you eat your placenta or do you store it?
Well, you know what? I'm a big believer that you should have options to do both if you want. And by the way, the placenta is such an abundant material, raw material, that we're actually working on a program that would allow people to bank cells, store away the important resources for themselves and their children, and also be able to have a product that they could also ingest as a supplement. So that's coming.
Okay. And so with, in terms of like where people go, because you have all these different companies, and if someone's listening here and they have an ailment that they think stem cells could be beneficial for, from what you had just listed, the vascular diseases and Crohn's disease and MS and all of these things, what's their first step?
So first and foremost, the internet is a remarkable resource for an abundant amount of information about cellular medicine. There's lots of places to go. LifeBankUSA.com is our front end to offer cell banking for expectant parents, and it is a remarkable resource that families can use to make decisions about how to get access to this material, store it away, and build a relationship that they'll carry on for the lifetime of their child. So it's LifeBankUSA.com.
Okay.
And Cellularity, like you said, with one L, CellularityY.com, is the parent company of the LifeBank business. That on that site, you can see how we talk about all the different clinical applications of these cells and a little bit more about the science and so on.
Got it. What is something that we don't know that this is helpful with? I feel like I heard something about plastic surgery elimination and in terms of like youth.
So here's an important message to get across. We are made up of trillions of cells that occupy a scaffold that is produced by those cells that form structural proteins. You've heard of things like collagen, right? Collagen is a structural protein. It is the beam in the wall of your tissues that you fill with the plaster that is made up of cells. Every cell comes from stem cells. We start out as a single cell that divides and gives rise to ever more specialized cell types that perform specific functions, brain, heart, liver, etc. Stem cells have the ability, what makes them unique is they have the ability to mature and specialize into all those different forms. A stem cell, I often say, is like a master boot disk. Okay? If you can store away stem cells at birth, that resource gives you an uncorrupted, perfect form of the biological software necessary to build every part of your body. When is that most important? It's most important when you're fighting disease, after an injury, or as a consequence of the things that basically disrupt us as we age. So stem cells, I believe, are the most richest, most profoundly powerful biological tool you have to maintain the regenerative engine that is necessary to maintain your health, your vitality, and your youthfulness. And so keep that in mind. Your cells and structure, the stem cell is the source of both.
So where do you get stem cells if you don't have a placenta?
Well, part of our mission is not just to create a way for people to store them away for their own purposes, but to also create an off-the-shelf product that can be used. Here's the great thing about the placenta. Placenta is is nature's professional allograft. What that means is nature has designed the placenta to be transmittable to anyone else. So think about this, right? Think about this. A mother carries a fetus for 9 months. She's only 50% genetically related to that fetus, but she doesn't reject it. It doesn't reject her. Okay? An organ you couldn't transplant that was only 50% related without it being rejected. So think about this. In surrogate pregnancy, a mother is not even related to the fetus that she's carrying. She doesn't reject it. It doesn't reject her.
So if I used a surrogate, that would be my placenta technically?
So if you donate the egg and sperm and a surrogate carries it, she won't reject it, but it's your DNA.
So I would be able to use that person's placenta.
Absolutely.
Genius.
Absolutely. And now the placenta can be taken off the shelf, one size fits all, and used in any recipient. We've treated hundreds and hundreds of patients. We've never matched them between the donor and the recipient.
I love that. Guys, we just found out how much more powerful women are than we even thought before. First, we give life. Now we save lives at the same time. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Bob Hariri.
Hope you guys enjoyed that segment. Now check out my interview with Detective Rod Demery as we discuss how murder chose him and his flawless track record.
Please welcome to the show, Detective Rod Demery. Welcome to Cali. So murder chose me. For people who don't know your backstory, tell everyone how you came to this kind of profession and also, you know, the title of the show.
Okay.
We need your microphone to come down so we can actually hear you. Wait, there, that one. There you go. Now we can hear you.
I guess I was destined to be a police officer, I think. My mother was murdered. I was 3 years old. After that, growing up and watching my grandparents, and you know, a few years later, my brother commits a murder. So all these things are starting to fall into place. When I talk about the profession or the calling, that's what I talk about it as. It's a calling. I can't think of anything else that would have prepared me better for that.
So was your brother's murder, was that in your teen years?
No.
How old were you?
I was in my 20s. I just gotten out of the Navy. And I was 28, man.
And was he older than you?
He's older than me, 2 years older than me.
Wow. So what was the circumstances around your mom's murder?
My mother was a victim of domestic violence. But growing up, I never knew that. I thought she got married a year after I was born. And the guy she married moved her to Texas while she was down there. He was abusive. And, you know, of course, I didn't know any of this growing up. And eventually he killed her. He just couldn't control her. As I got older, I started to look into it because I wanted to find out more about the story. And I actually went to Texas and just kind of dug up everything, all the police reports, autopsy reports, and, you know, even some of the witnesses that were there. And I put the story back together. Once I got the information, you know, as, you know, destiny would have it, the guy was in Shreveport in a hospital. He had had a heart attack and, late in his 70s. So I went in and interviewed him and videotaped it. And so it was just a regular homicide investigation at that point for me.
So hold on. You were a detective at the time.
Yes.
And so before you were a detective, you had already started piecing this together?
Right. Before I was a homicide detective at that time, I think I was a burglary detective.
Okay. And so then at some point, you track this guy, you find him, and you're like, I'm going to go film this because I have a feeling this is the guy?
Oh, yeah. I knew who he was, but the story that was told was that it was some sort of an accident or, you know, something, you know, crazy.
So
like
he was never prosecuted for this?
Never. He actually he was arrested the night it happened.
Mm-hmm.
He was in jail for a couple of months, I guess, until they had a grand jury. During that time, he told him it was an accident. He was asleep. He thought there was a burglar, and he started shooting. So,
So in your heart, you knew?
Oh, yeah, I knew.
And so you went and you asked him if you could film this?
I did. I went in and I told him I had a video camera and I filmed it. It was actually, we did an episode on it. And,
really?
And I actually saved the video footage of it. And it was, you know, at the time, I didn't know
what it was going to be for.
Yeah. But
wait, so did you tell him that you were her son?
Oh, he knew that. He knew exactly who I was. In fact, when I first met him, I didn't introduce myself. He just kind of knew who I was. Mm. And, you know.
So is it that thing where, you know, like, I don't know if it's just a movies thing where people know when the child grows up that they might have a, you know, vengeance or something might be coming, so they watch them carefully. Do you think he watched you?
I don't think so. I think it was more, probably guilt that he had internalized. And, you know, after I met him, I kind of, you know, it's funny because, or ironic, because I actually kind of felt sorry for him. You know, it's this old guy that looked like he had been tormented his entire life. And, clearly he's done what he's done, but I think probably the fact that, I think forgiveness is probably the big thing. If you can get those questions answered and forgive people, I think you can live a healthy life. Unfortunately, my brother was never able to do that, so he found himself, you know, in all sorts of other
trouble. So you forgave your mother's murderer?
I did.
And how do you think you got to that place?
I think, it's kind of a complicated story, but it took me a while to get to it. But I knew I was going to be a police officer. And when I was younger, my grandmother used to tell me that I was going to be a preacher of some sort. Well, you know, we grew up in a Southern Baptist church, and I knew from the scripture that if you are comforted by God, you're supposed to comfort somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, but as I grew up, I kind of pushed all that stuff away because I was, you know, not really into it at that point. And I also knew that I had been chosen to do whatever I was supposed to do. And scripture tells us that too, you know, before you're formed in your mother's womb, you know, I pretty much say what you're going to do. So I had the basic concept down, and I knew that the turmoil, just watching my brother, you know, with his anger, my grandmother with her, you know, despair that, you know, for whatever reason, I was spared. And so forgiveness was kind of an easy thing to do.
Wow. So you think you were spared of the level of pain that they all went through?
Yeah, yeah.
Was your brother older than you?
2 years older than me.
Okay.
And I think so. I talked to some high school students a couple months ago, and I explained that, you know, you should not ask the question of why has this happened, but why were you spared? And, you know, a little girl came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, that makes so much sense. And, I didn't realize I did that, but that's exactly what I did.
Wow.
So if you look at everything around you, you see how bad it is or how terrible things are, and you're the only person left there standing, then you kind of...
There's a reason.
You probably should ask why, you know.
So you interview him. What was that like? What were the highlight moments? I mean, you're catching him in a vulnerable time, right? He just had a heart attack.
Yeah.
He's in the hospital.
Yeah.
He's in his 70s. You know, he's had to live with this his whole life, or for many, many years at that point.
Yeah, you know, he was, he was clearly a broken man. I don't think he had the ability to tell the truth. You know, he kind of minimized it at that point. He said it was an accident. But, you know, he gave hints about, you know, how she was young and, you know, she would go out and that bothered him. He wanted to stay home and this, that, and the other. So he kind of, you know, went there. But I don't think he had the courage to just say, yeah, you know what, I did this. You know, I think he maintained this whole accident story until the very end.
Wow. Mm-hmm. But you knew.
Oh, yeah, I knew.
It didn't bother you that he wouldn't confess it to you?
No, not at all. I didn't expect it to, I guess.
You didn't need that for forgiveness.
Yeah. I think I've said before, I just wanted him to look at me and tell me that he shot my mother. And he did. But I know that was a challenge for him. And I think, admitting to anything else was even more. But, you know, it's in line with his personality. You know, he wants to control everything around him. And certainly didn't want to admit to that.
But you read between the lines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was a police officer then. I'd already read their autopsy reports. I knew exactly what happened. I talked to the witnesses, so, yeah.
So then your brother commits a murder. So how did that all end up?
Well,
what happened
I was actually in California when it happened. I had just gotten back from Japan. I was on a military deployment, and my brother came to me and told me he just killed somebody. And he shows up at my apartment. And, you know, he's covered in blood, you know, I was shocked and I said, you know, what, you know, are you sure? And his response was, yeah, I'm sure. That conversation lasted about 3 seconds and I'm looking at him and he said that, he wanted to leave. I said, well, no, I'm going to take you to the police station. And he wanted to stay and watch TV for a little while. In fact, he said he wanted to watch Oprah. So,
no way.
Yeah, I let him chill for like 45 minutes, and I took him to the police station.
He needed some chicken soup for his soul.
Yeah, yeah. So I took him to the police station, and
And he let you? Like, he wasn't fighting at all?
No, not at all.
He didn't want you
to
help him cover it up? Nothing, huh?
No, you know, and I think that my brother knew exactly what I was going to do. You know, I think the thought that I would take him somewhere, I don't think he believed that himself. But I took him to the police station, and I remember seeing the desk sergeant sitting at a desk like that, and I told him what happened. He said, well, you know, we don't know anything about it. And I said, no, listen, you know, this has really happened. So they found the detective, and that guy came down, and my brother got locked up. And he had been in prison probably 15 years before I seen him or spoke to him again.
Wait, were you a detective when he confessed to you?
No, I was just getting out of the military.
Oh, you were just getting out of the military. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Wow.
Yeah.
And so he goes to jail, and you didn't speak to him for 15
no,
years?
No. You know, that's the irony. I had more forgiveness for the guy who killed my mother than my brother, I think probably because, you know, he wasn't my brother. You know, it was just me and him.
Yeah.
And, you know,
himself away.
Right. And, you know, I've always been kind of a, you know, emotionless kind of guy, I guess. But I remember crying that day because I realized that it was just me.
Yeah.
And I was really angry with him for a long time. And, the funniest thing, I was in Louisiana and a friend of mine was supposed to be on the Wheel of Fortune, and we came out here and I just jumped in a car and drove and went to go see him. And since then, we've been able to talk more. But yeah, I had trouble with that. You know?
Wow. So yeah. How long has he been in jail for now?
24 years.
So a year 15, you guys finally spoke.
Yeah, year 15.
And now where is your relationship at?
We talk a lot now. Okay. You know, he's obviously a very different person now. You know, and, you know, he's grown, he's matured, so we can actually have conversations. And my brother's always been a very smart guy. So, you know.
So do you believe that what happened to your mom, in a sense, got him down a wrong path?
Yeah, I think... For a lot of different reasons, it's kind of symbolic, you know. And like I said, you know, you ask why you survive. And I got to see him take that route, and I got to see all the other destruction around me. And, you know, at the end, there I was, and I just didn't understand that. So, you know, leaving my grandparents' house and going out and being a man and doing what men do and just living the world, you know, out in the world, mm-hmm. I eventually reverted back to everything that I was taught in my spirituality, and it kind of got me back to balance.
And
took a while, though.
And your brother's murder, what was the situation around that?
My brother was into drugs and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some sort of dispute between him and the guy. In fact, I didn't even go to the trial. I didn't. After I took him to the police station, I just never looked at it again. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was really angry about that.
And so, and who did he murder?
Just a random guy. But, okay. You know what? This story gets so deep. So, you know, growing up and becoming a young man and doing whatever I got to do, you know, I didn't really have a grasp on a lot of things. And I knew that, you know, this whole TV thing there was a reason for it. Well, the show came out and I started getting all these emails from people everywhere. I mean, you know, all over the world. And I get an email with a phone number on it. And I never call those people because I don't know them. So I dial this number, and a girl answers the phone, and she's telling me she's 27. She has a 4-year-old kid. She's been married. And she says that her father was killed when she was 3 and my mother at 3. And, you know, we kind of shared a little bit, probably for about 15 minutes. And she told me she was the daughter of the guy that my brother killed.
Mm.
Yeah. So that was a pretty defining moment. Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So now, do you think your brother, because this is the thing, right? When people commit these terrible crimes, they go to jail and some of them, you know, find God and they, you know, supposedly change. And, you know, I think it's left to us to kind of, you know, battle that. Did they really? Are they lying? Will they be a threat later? Do you think someone like your brother has truly changed and reformed and he's not a danger anymore?
I can't honestly say I could answer that question. And the reason I say that is, you know, it's not that of course that I think that he's evolved, he's grown and stuff. But I've been asked that question, you know, like if he was up for parole or he's going to get out. I just don't think I have a say in that. You know, it's within me to be able to say I can forgive my brother or he's a great person. But I don't know that I'm the person to do that for the victim because, you know, they're the ones who had suffered through that. And, you know, that's that thing, you know, you got to separate the crime from the criminal. And, you know, I know my brother, but also know what my brother's done. So
yeah.
I don't think I could ever put myself in a position where I can make that judgment. And I wouldn't, actually. Yeah. So.
Wow. Yeah. So the sum of all these parts have probably made you that successful in what you do.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah, because everything else I had totally sucked at.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to hear about the things you don't suck at and get more information on this show. We'll be right back with more from Detective Demery.
From news and pop culture to fitness and health to relationships and careers.
This is Conversations with Maria Menounos.
Guys, we are back with the star of Murder Chose Me, Detective Rod Demery. And in the commercial break, we were trying to solve the mystery of Daryl's dying birds. Oh, detective, what do you think this is?
I don't know. I just don't think it's an accident.
But it could be a good thing, right? Maybe it's a good omen, right?
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Yeah, birds dying everywhere you go. No, Daryl. So Murder Chose Me. Now we know why the show is titled Murder Chose Me. Tell me what it's like doing this show. Like, you've been doing this as a career for so long. Now you're doing it on TV. What is that like for you?
Yeah, totally different. It's really weird, actually. You know, working cases and going out at 3 a.m. and then switching to this place where you see all these wonderful people, and you know, it's a change. It's good though. It's a good change.
So now the show is reenactments. Mm-hmm. So you're now having to act.
Well, there's
in a way,
guy
right?
That's me. John Nicholson plays me, and he does.
No
all
wonder
the
I was like, he it didn't look. I saw just like the trailer. I'm like, that didn't look like him. Maybe he lost a lot of weight or something. I don't know.
And like, I sit there and kind of. Like, yeah, actually,
when
I
you
did,
walked
though.
In, I go, he looks so different.
Yeah. Everybody says it.
You know what?
It's not double.
You know what it is, detective? It's my millennial's laptop. It was so filthy.
Oh,
I couldn't even see.
Josh on blast.
I thought you were Asian. See, Josh, the ramifications of a dirty laptop.
I didn't realize there'd be such severe consequences.
Oh,
see? Severe consequences. Okay, so all of this is being reenacted and you're narrating the whole thing.
Right.
Okay, got it. So you don't have to do any acting.
So they come back to me and they go to the actual reenactment. And so it's pretty easy for me because I just tell the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other people have talent because I don't.
I heard that you have potential career aspirations to be the mayor of Shreveport. Is that true?
Well, I've been asked a lot. And you know what? I think that's probably the most flattering thing that's ever happened to me. You know, when I have people coming up to me and saying, hey, you want to run for office? It's a good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not I want to do that, you know, I'm still kind of meditating on that and in prayer on it because I don't know if politics is my thing.
Yeah.
You know, if there were... Or if I can figure out a way to actually just do what I do and not have to deal with all the other stuff on the side, I'd probably do it in a heartbeat. But other than that, it's so nasty.
I know. Yeah, I always thought I was going to be president someday.
You still could?
I really did. I lived my life like prepping for it. Yeah. And I was just like, you know, really careful. Yeah. And Kevin's like, Maria, they'll kill you. And I'm like, I know. I don't think I have the... the skin for it.
Unfortunately, people in politics don't really care about the issues or the facts. It's more about the power
and getting
whatever.
Reelected. It's unbelievable.
So I don't know. I've given a lot of thought, but I still haven't came to a decision yet on that.
So now, when you are investigating a case, how do you think you approach things differently than other investigators, and that's why you've had the success rate?
I think I'm obsessed, you know, because it's very difficult for me to think about anything else. And, you know, that translates into a regular life is really bad. And, you know, what makes you a good police officer kind of makes you not so good of a friend, person, or whatever, because you don't think about anything except that.
So you're not married?
No.
I'm like, let me just go out on a limb here.
I think the thing that I've heard most of my quasi-relationship life was, I guess I got to get killed before I get time with you. That's really low.
That's a hell
good,
of an opening line.
Oh, you missed my birthday.
See, that's the key to success in anything. You have to give it your 1,000,000,000%.
Absolutely.
There's just no other way, I don't think.
I was completely obsessed with it. And I think, I mean, for good reason. I mean, it's very difficult to make a death notification and then go home, you know. You got to figure out what happened, but so it didn't work out.
Do you feel like anybody is capable of murder?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah
I think it's definitely an innate instinct. I think people are probably, some people are more, you know, easily provoked to that, but I think so
you don't put it past anybody when you're dealing with someone?
No. I think that's probably the biggest misconception. You know, people have this idea of what the boogeyman looks like. Not so. You know, it's anybody that, you know, I always equate it to a an adult temper tantrum, you know, when people just lose complete control. And you know, most people afterwards go, oh, wow, you know, and most murder suspects, when you're interrogating them, they have that look like, I can't believe this has happened.
How do you get them to confess?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's, I always think that people want to tell. You know, I don't think that anyone can kill somebody and not tell somebody. The trick is making them think that they can tell you. And I think that's probably just being non-judgmental, because I think right off the top, somebody can tell if you know, you're just being judgmental.
Yeah.
But if you're like really listening to what they have to say, they, most people want to tell you why it happened.
Yeah. You must use your own experience to comfort them, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm sure that helps.
It does. And I think, and it works both ways, because you get a lot of cooperation from the survivors or the surviving victims, because you can actually relate to them and you know what they're feeling, you know their pain. And for the people who commit the murders, you can relate to them too, because you can tell that, you know, at some point this was, you know, just a regular person.
A
probably
normal,
still
sweet
is,
person,
right?
Yeah, maybe even.
Yeah, and I think that comes across and that works. And you know, I think it's just about being sincere and non-judgmental. And yeah, it's not really personal, I guess. You know, you don't, you know, you're not mad at the person who did it. You know, you know what you have to do. But yeah, well, some people get mad at it.
More brutal, the more anger that goes with it. But it's interesting, like, you know, with people who do bad things, the fact that we're all capable of it should say one thing, should say something, you know what I mean? And then the people who actually carry it out, you know, there's so much damage generally that has occurred that if we didn't know the end result, we would have empathy for them. Right? Or we would hope that we would have empathy for their plight and their journey. That, you know, it's kind of a tough thing. Like, you know, that's why, like, I'm always so impressed by the people who forgive people who do these things. And we just had this author on, New York Times bestselling author. Her name is Anita Morjani. And she had a near-death experience. And she talks about when she's on the other side in the other realm, that there were no bad people. There was no hell. There was just forgiveness and peace. And you know, you wonder, like, how could that be? Yeah. How could somebody who's a serial killer, you know, be forgiven and just be there? But that's what she saw. And she's like, those people need more empathy and more compassion. I know that is a really hard concept for all of us to wrap our heads around. But
You know, but I think for forgiveness, I think that's something that's for you.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter about the other person, because they kind of don't matter. But if you allow those things to just kind of consume you, you know, regardless of what it is, it's going to consume you.
And you're a victim now, too.
Yeah, yeah. And you are. And, you know, the girl that I talked to, that my brother killed her father, that was my comment to her. It's just like, you know, you have a child now, and you can't allow him to victimize your child because you're absent. And, you know, so forgiveness is kind of a personal thing, and, you know, it's tough to do. You know, no one says you have to like them, you know, but I think you should probably, just for your own personal comfort, you probably should do that, and everyone around you, because it kind of, you know, growing up for me, it was like I could see that pain that my grandmother was going through, and, you know, the worry that my grandfather had and my brother. So I think, you know, getting that to a point where, you know, you have to. I mean, because if you can't, then it's going to continue to victimize. So,
did you watch the video of O.J. Simpson's confession recently?
I didn't, but
I would love to get your viewpoint on that, since you could tell when people are lying. I would love to have gotten your viewpoint on that.
It was unbelievable. You know why you could tell he was lying? His body language changed. When he would tell the truth, he would lean forward more and furrow his brow, and his whole energy changed. When he was lying, he would kick back and be charming like joke about it. There were two moments in there where he told the truth, and both times he leaned forward and everything changed. It was a visible, obvious change.
I've heard about that. I didn't see it.
Oh, it's magnificent.
I think that early on, and it's like so important, like early on when somebody is a suspect in a crime, that they are interrogated, because it's impossible for them to do anything except tell what happened.
You know,
it's that buildup, you know, that psychological buildup where they don't know what you know and what you don't know. You wait 3-4 weeks or even years and they know you don't have anything. So,
No,
I didn't see that, but
I've
heard
about it.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
It's so good.
And obviously Louisiana has gotten, you know, some bad press with the law enforcement. I mean, we just had Alton Sterling's cops that were freed and not being charged with his murder. How is the racial tension between like civilian and cops just overall in Louisiana?
You know, I think it's probably it's got the same trend, you know, nationwide. And I think people are, you know, it's unfortunate that people don't really realize what police officers do. And, you know, and that's not the public's problem, that's a police problem. And, you know, I always say that, you know, if the public withdraws from the police, then the police are doing something wrong. And you know, I don't know that I would say that, you know, there are huge racial tensions between the police because some bad policemen are black. So
yeah, that's true.
You know, so it's a, you know, I think it's a way to kind of broad stroke something. And I think the answer to that is that the leadership in policing has to change. And and you can't say enough about that. I mean, people, I don't think the community is bad. I think they don't have the things that they need. So it's kind of, leadership is just starting to falter.
So. Well, Detective Rod Demery, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story. You guys can watch Murder Chose Me in their second season, premiering on Wednesday, April 4th. That's next week, right?
Yes.
Next Wednesday at 10, 9 Central on Investigation Discovery.
And follow us at Maria Menounos, at SiriusXM Stars, at Miss Ashley Daniels, at Josh_Rodriguez_. And remember, guys, be nice people, make good choices, and be present.